Thank you everybody for being here this morning and worshiping together, and I appreciate the songs that we've sung. There's some Sundays where I just want to keep singing, and I appreciate the job you did this morning, Seth. I just want to keep going. On that note, let's talk about a psalm. Turn over in your Old Testaments to Psalm 139. Now, Mark read the last few verses of 138 for us from our reading this last week. And we're going to spring just a little bit forward from 139, another Psalm of David. And there's a reason for that. I was thinking about what Mike had shared the other day about getting close to the end of the year and doing evaluations. And I really loved what he shared about Ellen not growing because she was comparing herself to the moving target of her sister. I think every parent can relate to that with their kids. His point was that we need to do self-evaluations. We need to look at ourselves and see what we need to change and areas that we need to grow, and that's exactly right. And to help us do that, I wanted to spring a little bit into 139, because what David asks in 139 in three different places, in verse 1, verse 3, and at the very end in verse 23, is he asks God to evaluate him. So what he says in verse 1 is, O Lord, you have searched me and known me. In verse 3, he says, you search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. And then in verse 23, he says, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. And this isn't the only place that biblical writers do this. Jeremiah talks about it. Psalm 26 talks about it. Solomon talks about it in Proverbs 4. There's just giving God the opportunity to look at us and reveal what's going on inside of us and things that we need to change. So let's take the time this morning to talk about allowing God to do an evaluation on us and help us see where we need to grow. Now, I really appreciate what David does in Psalm 139 is because he doesn't start exactly with himself. He starts with God, because God is the one who built him. And there's some significance to that. You think about anyone who has built anything, like the Crooked House of Windsor. That really needed some evaluating as it was going up. Someone needed to pull a level. Actually, I did some research on that. I was looking for crooked structures. Obviously, you've got the Leaning Tower of Pisa, but this one, I mean, it just looked visually, it's pretty. It's a pretty picture. What happened with that was it started straight. It was actually a land dispute. There had been a house there, but the town wanted to build the building just to the left of it, and so they knocked it down, and come to find out, they didn't have the right to knock it down, and so they rebuilt it, and they did it quickly, and they used some uncured timbers, and so as the timber in the house cured, it naturally went wonky. You know, there wasn't much you can do about it. Now it's a national monument landmark. People go there and they take selfies in front of it and behind it. And they really could have done a better job evaluating how they were building that, or asking somebody else to evaluate how they were building that. We need to allow God to evaluate us. It's one thing to try to evaluate ourselves to a moving target of somebody else. It's another thing to just only get our opinion on, well, I'm doing great. Or I need to let God, the master builder, the one who created me, the one who knows me, let him give some input into how I'm doing. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about inviting God's evaluation. Let's start by reading the first six verses of Psalm 139. David writes, O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You hem me in behind and before and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain it. We've already kind of established this. I need to let God give a close inspection on me and my life and my motives and my behavior. I need to let God speak to me about me. It's not enough for me to just kind of, I think I'm doing all right now. I need to let God speak to me about how I'm doing. You know, over in Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 23, one of the things that Jeremiah says is it's not in man's way to direct his own steps. It's not up to me to determine which way I should go or be the ultimate final word on how I'm doing. I'm not in a position to do that. I need to let God do that. And think about it, am I really ready to ask God to do that? The word search that's used three times in 139 is the word for scrutinize. So we're not talking about just a cursory glance. There's a reason there's a magnifying glass there. We're asking God to get down to the nitty-gritties. Look at verse 23. What he asks him to scrutinize is my heart. God, get down inside of me and look at my motives. Look at my intentions. The thing that not everybody else can see, God, I want you to see that part of me and let me know how I'm doing. That is an intimate thing to ask. And that's a humbling thing to ask. To invite someone into that part of your life to see how you're doing. But we need God to do that. And He's the only one who can do it for us. One of the things that David says in Psalm 26, verse 2 is, "Put me on trial, Lord. Put me on trial and cross-examine me. Test my motives and my heart." That's the New Living Translation. Does anybody really want to go and sit down and say, "Okay, God, I'm going to give an answer, and then once I give an answer, you can come at me from different directions to see if that's really the truth"? But that's what David is inviting. It takes a humility to let God do that. God's already done it. Actually, it's humbling to let God speak to you about it. He already knows. What David reveals by all of this, by verse 23 and by Psalm 26, he understands that what I do, the things that I choose, the behavior that I engage in, that those things are an overflow of what's going on inside of my heart. That's why I need God to look at my heart. He already understands that. "You are acquainted with all my ways," verse 3. Think about what else he says that God knows. "Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether." Even before it comes out of my mouth, you know what I'm going to say. This is the perfect time of year to use this illustration. So, after a crushing loss in football, prior to the next game, what does the coach do with his players? One of the things that they do is they sit down and they start reviewing the tape. This is the next opponent. This is what they're used to doing. This is what their defense does. This is what their offense does. These are their favorite plays. This is what they're likely to do. And then they're calling those plays during the game. This is their lineup. We think this is what they're going to do. Let's get our guys ready for that. They read the play. They anticipate what may happen. You realize that God can do that with us? God knows. He already knows what we're going to do before we line up. You realize if we're paying attention as parents, we can tend to do that. I know my child. And given the circumstances, I would wager 95% that my child is going to do this or say this because I know my child. Right? God knows us. He knows us that way. And you think about how well God knows us, and at the end of that paragraph, David just goes, "That kind of knowledge is too wonderful for me." In verse 6. Like, I can't fathom how God knows every individual that well. That's incredible. So what he's emphasizing is I need to remember that God knows me. And He knows me better than anyone else knows me. He knows my strengths. He knows my weaknesses. I think what he's trying to establish is God is qualified. God's qualified to evaluate me. Let's come down to verses 7 through 12. He starts asking a question. "Where shall I go from your spirit? Where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you're there. If I take the wings of the morning, he's describing the east, and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, he's talking about the west for them, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me by night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. What is he saying? He's saying that no matter where you go, God is there. And for him, he's saying, God is with me. That's what he's establishing in verse 7. Where shall I go from your spirit? Where shall I flee from your presence? And the answer is nowhere. God is with David, wherever he goes. So he talks about up, down, east, west. There's no direction that he can go where God is not already there. God is present. He's all-knowing. He's actually there before the psalmist is there because God is everywhere. You know, we have those cartoons that the kids watch where there's a chase scene and the character that's running away opens the door and the other character's already behind it. You know, God is present. He's there. And that's a comfort to the psalmist. That wouldn't necessarily be a comfort to everyone, but I need to remember that God is with me. Let's look at verses 13 through 16. For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there were none of them. Now you realize this is poetry. You realize he's using figurative language to describe something that he can't see. Because I don't know a single baby that was, you know, formed down in the darkest parts of the earth. He's just trying to say there's this process that's hidden from his sight. And it's a baby being formed in the womb. And we come to this passage and we try to make the point, look, life starts at conception. That's absolutely right. Although that's not David's point. So is it an accurate point? Yes. Is it his main point? No. His main point is that God is the one behind that process. God is the one directly involved in that process. And verse 13 really sets off the whole paragraph. Who is it that forms the inward parts? He says it's God. Who knitted him together in his mother's womb? God. Think about people who build a house. We'll talk about, this is the house that we built. Did they? I mean, did they get in there with hammers and saws and materials and assemble the house? No, we understand. What they ended up doing is they probably hired a general contractor, and that general contractor probably subbed out the various disciplines. He brought in an electrician, he brought in a plumber, he brought in craftsmen, all these different trades. He had someone that handled the kitchen. He had guys doing the drywall, because drywall is just dusty and it's not fun. Drywall is not fun. And he subs it out, right? So when the owner says, I built a house, it's rare that he meant, I got in there and did that. It means he subbed it out. He got qualified people to do it. Do you realize in verse 13, when the psalmist is saying, God formed me, God made me, God didn't sub that out. God didn't sub it out. God was involved with that. God created him. God created him. And he did that because he cares for him. So what he's been doing for the last three paragraphs is he's been trying to emphasize how good God is and how involved God is with him from start to finish. He knows me. He's with me. He cares about me because he made me. Look, there's furniture in my house. I just know it's got a certain life. And after so long, I'm going to replace it. I just know that. Like my couches, they're on their last leg. Anna's so super patient about those couches. Right? And after we replace those couches, I know it's only going to be so many years before we get rid of those couches. But there are some pieces of furniture in that house that, Lord willing, and if Jesus doesn't come back, that I'll pass it along to a kid, to one of my children, because I made that piece of furniture. And I hope I made it so that it will last longer than the lifespan of the couch. I have more invested in that. And at the end of the day, if something happens to it, look, it's just furniture. But it means more to me than the disposable furniture because I'm invested in it. What the psalmist is saying, what David is saying, is God cares so intimately because I'm His. He made me. He made me. He isn't just aware of my life. He cares about it. I like how he describes that care in verse 16. When he says, "Your eyes saw my unformed substance, and in your book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them." God knew the story of my life before I lived it out. That's amazing. Now, that doesn't remove free will. That's not what he's saying. But he's simply talking about the scope of God's omniscience. Now, if that's the case, if the first three paragraphs, God knows me, He's with me, He cares about me because He made me, if those things are true, then verses 17 through 22 make sense. "How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them." Who do you want evaluating you? Who is most qualified? And I think what the psalmist is arguing is the person most qualified is this person. The one who knows me, He's with me, He cares about me, He made me. That person is qualified. I value what he thinks. "How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them." You can't count the number of thoughts that God has had for David. He's trying to say they're vast. God's been thinking about me that much, I can't number them. They're vast. And God has had a similar number of thoughts about every individual in this room. God's been thinking about you, and He's been thinking about your life. "If I would count them, they are more than the sand." And when I picture that now, I picture like Florida sand, not Pacific Coast sand. Because Pacific Coast sand is like gravel. I mean, it's just not much better than gravel. Because it's this pulverized rock, it's really gritty. But the first time that I stepped into sugar sand, I was like, this is sand. Right? So much more fine. If you were to count the number of thoughts God had about you, it's more than sand. "If I awake, I'm still with you." And then he shifts gears. "Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. O man, men of blood, depart from me. They speak against you with malicious intent. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with complete hatred. I count them my enemies." And every Westerner in the room just kind of cringed because that's so not politically correct. Look, I cringe a little every time I read that, and it's because of the culture that I'm in and that I grew up in. That is not a tolerant paragraph. But let's put it in the context of the psalm. Remember what David has said about God in the first several paragraphs. This is a God who knows him intimately. This is a God that is always with him. This is a God who cares about him. Because he made him, and that is true about every person. And then he starts to describe his response to that kind of God. "I value you, and I love you, and I want to know what you think, and the thoughts that you have are amazing." And then in verses 19 through 22, he describes people that are against that God. These people that are living against God and harming people that are created in God's image by God. These are people against God. And there's a phrase to describe this type of prayer, this type of psalm. It's called imprecatory, in that because he's calling down God's judgment and God's wrath on the people that are against God. And we always had a phrase that we used to describe in precatory psalms. The psalmist is calling out to God to leave things smoking and broken, because he's calling on God to come down and judge. And a lot of times that judgment language, there's not much left when God is done. And there are times that I think we need to develop that sense of God's attitude against wickedness. And I think we need to get there. I need to revere God and value His thoughts. And I need to see sin the same way that God does. These people are not necessarily against the psalmist to be against the psalmist. David is at odds with them because they are against God. And David has a perspective on sin because of God's perspective on sin. And I need to develop that perspective. Does that mean I can still be compassionate toward people that have sinned against me and demonstrate forgiveness toward them and be merciful and try to help them come to Christ? Yes. Because I am them. But there's a time and a place where I need to be stronger against sin than even our culture is. Think of some of these verses and how they describe sin. We'll rattle down about four or five. Isaiah 1 and verse 6, when describing how sinful Israel was as a nation, Isaiah says, "From the sole of the foot even to the head, there is no soundness in it, but bruises and sores and raw wounds. They are not pressed out or bound up or softened with oil." He says, this nation is so sinful, it's like their sin is a festering sore. That's how God sees their sin as a nation. Or in Psalm 38 and verse 4, "My iniquities have gone over my head like a heavy burden. They are too heavy for me." And so the psalmist in that psalm sees sin as this metaphorical burden placed on the person that has sinned against God. And every time they sin, that burden just gets a little bit heavier. Or in Titus 1:15, "To the pure all things are pure, but to the defiled and unbelieving nothing is pure. Both their minds and their consciences are defiled." What is Paul telling Titus? He's comparing sin and the life of sin as if something was defiled and defiling, something was dirty. And we're not just talking about, you know, your kid fell down and got a little bit of dirt on their pants. Like, this person is covered in filth. Spiritually, that's where they are. Or in Matthew chapter 6, verses 12 through 15 in the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus is teaching them how to pray, and he teaches them to say, "Forgive us our debts, as we've also forgiven our debtors." And I think that also applies to sin. That sin is this debt that just continues to grow. Or in 1 John 1, verse 6, "If we say we have fellowship with Him while we walk in darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth." Where sin and a life of sin is described as being dark. And finally, Isaiah again, Isaiah chapter 1, verse 18. He invites the Israelites, this is God saying, "Come now, let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they shall become like wool." The sin is described like this glaringly bright stain on them. None of those are pleasant. I'll tell you what. We're not going to turn to God, and other people are not going to turn to God until they learn to see themselves the way that God sees them spiritually. And it's not good. Unless I have been baptized with Christ and had my sins, those sins, atoned for, unless that has happened and I am a believer, then spiritually it's like God is looking at me and I have sores and wounds that are festering. It's like I'm carrying a huge burden that will not be removed from my back. I am the dirtiest person you could ever see. Or I have a debt I could never repay. I'm walking about blind in darkness. And on top of all of that, there's a big, big crimson stain on me. We need to see sin the way that God sees sin. And so when you come back to Psalm 139 and you have David, who's under the old covenant, he's someone who loves God, he's been offering sacrifices that foreshadow the sacrifice of Jesus. He's in a right relationship with God at this point. But there are these people that are hostile toward God and hostile toward other righteous people, and they're sinning. And David's like, God, make them stop. It gives us a little bit better perspective. And there's something else that he understands, that wickedness and evil is not just this abstract idea. You know, people get on the blogs and, what is evil? And they start to parse out evil. We need to stamp out evil. David understands that evil is attached to the person committing the evil. It's not just an abstract idea. It's something that someone does because of who they are. So what's the answer? They need to be changed. Who they are needs to be changed. Have you ever thought about that? Now, let's just jump on a little soapbox for just a second. Okay? I'm going to come to the side. Here's my soapbox. That's not my soapbox. Think about that for a second. How does the Bible describe someone who habitually lies? What are they called? A liar. Right? When does that change? When do we stop calling them a liar? Well, according to Ephesians chapter 4, once they've been forgiven and once they stop lying and once they start putting on truth and they start telling truth because now they're in Christ, we don't call them by what they used to do. We now call them an honest person, right? But they've been redeemed, they've been forgiven, and they've replaced their attitudes and their behavior, right? What do we call someone who habitually takes things that don't belong to them? They're a thief. They're a thief. They're a robber. By their behavior, there's a descriptor that's attached to them. So when we come back to Psalm 139, and David says, look, there are wicked people. Wickedness is not some abstract idea out there. It's attached to the people who are committing wicked things. They're doing wicked deeds. I need to see sin the same way that God sees sin. Now, the psalm starts by saying, God, you've already searched me. You have already searched me. And in verse 3, he says, God, you search out my path. You know which way I'm going. And after he describes how incredible God is, he comes down to verse 23 and he invites him to search him anew. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. God is more than qualified. And not only is he qualified, but he's going to do it better than anybody else because of his care for him. Is it humbling? Yes. Is it painful? Yes. Is it for our good? Yes. Does it glorify God when we respond the way that we should? Absolutely. And it makes a mess of your life if you don't. It makes a mess of your life if you don't. Let's look at one more example of needing closer scrutiny. Let's look at another structure. I was not going to use the person with the selfie holding up the Leaning Tower of Pisa. But you know, that's an interesting story about how that building came to be. And it's probably because it was built in so many phases over so much time that it's still standing. Because when they built the first two levels several hundred years ago, they didn't realize that the soil that it was on one side wasn't strong enough to hold up what was planned. And for several reasons, they had to stop construction for political reasons, military reasons. And as that was going on, it started to tilt just with the first couple of levels. And they thought, well, we don't want to scrap this. What are we going to do? So they came along and started adjusting. And when you get a closer picture of this, you can see it. It's actually not a perfect cylinder, because a perfect cylinder would have taken it down. They started making corrections and adjustments to account for what was revealed in the foundation. When you look at it and you start hearing the numbers, on one side there are a couple fewer stairs than on the other side because they didn't need them. When you start looking inside the rooms of the higher towers, they're not a perfect rectangle because one wall is built a little bit taller to account for that list. So the tower actually curves up as it's built. And what was going on was once they recognized the design flaw, They couldn't fix it without just demolishing it. But they recognized there's something going on here, and we need to account for that. We need to correct that. We need to fix that. And so over the centuries, as they continued to build it, they did. Do you realize each and every single one of us, we're flawed. We're flawed by our sin. You're flawed by the sin that you've committed. I'm flawed by the sin that I've committed. And God sees that sin just like the passages that we looked at described. That's not good. And you have a decision to make. Am I going to just ignore the evaluation that I've received from God and just continue on my life as if God's thoughts don't count? I mean, that's going to lead you to spiritual ruin. Or are you going to trust the evaluation of the one who created you and cares about you and knows you better than even your mother? And trust that you need to respond to the evaluation that he's given. And not only has he given an evaluation, he's provided the correction. Forgiveness in Christ. Now, if you've become a Christian, then this becomes an ongoing process. I'm going to keep coming back to God, saying, God, how about now? How am I doing now? And Mike's point was, you know, the end of the year is a great time to do that. It is. To let God give you another evaluation, how can I grow this year as a believer? Do I need to do better in my prayer life? Do I need to be doing better in my worship attendance? Do I need to be doing better as a husband, better as a wife, better as a child? Do I need to do better at school? How do I relate to others in my life? Am I sharing the gospel like I should? I mean, there are so many areas of your life that you can just come to God and let Him and His Word scrutinize you for your good. As you let God evaluate you this morning, has it revealed that you're still in sin? If so, we want to help you take care of that as soon as possible. We want that sin removed. We want you to be in a relationship with God and not have it be a terror to you that God is everywhere. We want that to be a comforting thought. And if you're a Christian, be thinking about, as God evaluates me, and He does it because He loves me and He's qualified, what are some areas that you need to grow in? What are some areas that I need to grow in? Think about that. And if there's anybody that needs to respond to David's psalm this morning, please do that while we stand and sing.